Blog Talk Radio.
Getting It Right with Dr. Bowles. Good afternoon. This is Dr. Velva Bowles. Thank you so much for joining me. I would love to have some conversation concerning today's topic, and you can phone in at 347-945-6594. The topic today, vaccination. Who has the right to choose? If you have been following the news, you will know that there is a measles epidemic, and predominantly in the on the West Coast. I don't think it has affected the East Coast. But over the years, there have been raging controversy about immunizing children, and it has had strong emotional outcry. There was a senator's hearing that concerned one of the senator's children had gotten a vaccine, and the allegations were that these vaccines were introducing neurological problems, autism, and so many other kind of conditioning. And in that investigation, because it involved such high-up officials, showed that some of the pharmaceutical companies were adding these really harsh chemicals to the vaccines, not that it did anything to improve the health of those receiving the vaccine, but rather extended the shelf life of the vaccine. And sometimes it was really a bottom line was money. And there was, if I remember in the hearings, one of the pharmaceutical CEOs or high-ranking officials was caught on tape saying he was not going to allow his grandson to receive the very vaccine that his company was making because he didn't like the addition of thermisterol was the compound in question, which is a mercury compound. And for those of you who are not familiar, it is well documented that mercury causes extreme mental conditions and in children retardation. It can affect bone growth and so much other things. And unfortunately, at the time, they were adding doses of thimerosal to vaccines given to newborns. New parents know that within the first 3 months of life, there is a frenzy of shots that a child gets. Of course, children get shots where they leave the hospital. If they were born in a hospital, they return in 2 weeks, then 6 weeks, and then 3 months, and so forth and so on until they're 18 months old. What I've shared with you in the blog is that the big question is, do parents have the right to say no? Well, the movement, which was probably more energetic in the mid-90s, when a number of parents, usually highly educated, high socioeconomic level, said that they had a right to decide whether or not they wanted their child to be exposed to these artificially or laboratory synthesized or some kind of laboratory modified viruses. And it was kind of a yuppie movement, an upward mobile kind of person saying, no, I'd rather have my child get natural immunities and so forth. The unfortunate thing is while that kind of movement was growing, so was the anti-everything. They had antibacterial soaps, so you took a bath and you got rid of all your bacteria, and antibacterial dishwashing detergent. You had antibacterial pumps on every hall in the schools, and parents were starting to buy antibacterial alcohol-based hand cleansers they carried in their purse. So what reason I said, unfortunately, there was a double dip here that when you're so busy getting rid of all the bacteria that a child can be exposed to, bacteria and viruses, then the child's immune system has no chance to ever become familiar. I've had this conversation with others who were born into a blue-collar or less family, such as myself, where the older children became caretakers to the younger children, and often instead of sitting in front of a television, which we didn't own until we were up to a certain age, certainly didn't have a telephone until I was a teenager, we went outside. The whole concept is you got up, you cleaned whatever your assignment was, whether it was the bathroom or baby diapers because there were no disposables, or mopping the kitchen floor or whatever the task mom assigned. Then you went outside, and outside meant jump rope and hopscotch and just whatever you could think of, honeybee catching, butterfly catching, frog, tadpole catching. But in those times that we were outside, we were able to get exposed. The dirt was under our fingernails. We played in the dirt. Sometimes we may even have been barefooted. So whatever was out there in nature, we had a chance to be exposed. Of course, when we came at night, we got bathed. But that exposure allows your body to start making B cells and T cells and revving up your immune system so that you're not totally defenseless in the event you should get exposed. Now, Mom was an expert at doing things like dosing us with castor oil at least twice a year, and that prevented any kind of intestinal parasites. We even had something that involved a half teaspoon of sugar and turbutyme. I know people tell me it's toxic. Mom said it made sure that you didn't get tapeworm or any of the whipworms. And I have to say, I have 7 brothers and sisters. The shortest one among them is me, and I'm 5'9". So we grew up big. We grew up strong. We had no money for hospitalization or doctors. So whatever it was Mom was doing didn't kill us, but it did certainly make us stronger. Well, what does that have to do with anything? Well, if at the same time children are never getting a chance to educate their immune system, they also are not getting a chance to have artificially education of their immune system, you're really setting that child up to live in a bubble. Now, if you're in Upper East Hamptons in New York or the East Coast, or you're in some elite neighborhood where all the children are in pristine environment and have no reason to be concerned with the outside world and its troubles of viruses and bacteria, then okay, you can do that. But if the children who have not had an education of the immune system are exposed to children who have been vaccinated, or worse yet, children who have any kind of immune or compromised immune system, the unvaccinated, the naive immunological system of these children can give rise to an epidemic. And it's evidenced in what's going on the West Coast with the measles epidemic. Now, measles is a childhood disease, and if the child is not immune compromised, it's a 21-day, sometimes a, I think it's 21 to 40-day run of this infection. It's very high temperature, so there's a risk for fever. There are complex spots in the mouth, which can make it difficult for them to eat. There's a risk of dehydration and extremely miserable. It's like having the worst flu plus some red painful spots everywhere. Now, a child, like I said, who has a strong immune system can recover. I don't know if the family will feel so good about it, but that's a child who's going to be sick, out of school, dependent on comfort, Tylenol for fever, very sensitive care to feedings, perhaps some intravenous fluid provisions, and the potential that any other sibling that has not been vaccinated, you can have multiple children with this disease at the same time. Well, let's say in the 1970s and 60s, parents dealt with that. In fact, I can remember parents talking about, oh, your child has chickenpox or measles, let me bring mine over. They wanted to have that exposure so they could get it out of the way before the child went to school. I can remember the discussion about mumps and chickenpox and so forth. Now, the issue is we have a number of children, more than I would have imagined, who are survivors because of transplantation. We've come so far since the mid-80s that children who may not have been alive because of some kind of liver defect or bowel defect or pancreas defect, kidney defect, now are alive because of transplantation. If a parent donates partial liver transplants or a kidney transplant, so a child can look perfectly healthy. We've come so far with our rejection medication or anti-rejection medication. But this child is a sitting duck because they have no immune system, because by virtue of anti-rejection transplantation medicine renders this child immune suppressed. So if your healthy, robust child has never been vaccinated, happens to contract a virus, chickenpox, measles, or whatever, through its natural course, and they are in daycare or in some kind of sitting service, and they are exposing a child who has had any kind of organ transplant to this virus, it is like you're shooting the transplanted child in the head, literally, because viruses are notorious for taking over defenseless things. Look at HIV. When that virus gets in the body, and we haven't found a cure to this date after, almost 30 years, the reason it kills people is it keeps changing its spots. It looks like this today and then something else a couple of months from now, and consequently it still is triumphing despite all of the breakthroughs we've had. Well, viruses are known to be notorious for that reason. So if your child, under natural, regular, run-of-the-day methods, contract a virus, which is a childhood disease, we call them that for a reason, then if you chose not to have them vaccinated, the big question is, are you obligated to keep this child sequestered? Is it fair for you to allow an innocent child be exposed when it could cost them their life? Well, the biggest question mark, I don't think any parent, not a reasonable parent, would send a child out with a fever or red spots or chicken pox, but there is a thing called the prodromal period, and that is a time when there are no spots. Chicken pox does not have the little vesicles. Measles do not have the red spots. Child may not have a fever. They may have a runny nose. They have a little bit of a scratchy throat and a headache. They are contagious at that stage. So where a parent who is in corporate America thinks the child may have the sniffles and they're conscientious enough to give them Tylenol and tell the caretaker they have the sniffles and I'll definitely be here when school's out to pick them up and he'll do a lot of sleeping, may innocently be setting a time bomb for someone else's child who cannot afford to be exposed to the live, active viruses known as childhood diseases. Well, the Center for Disease Control recommends that there are up to 28 doses, that's an awful lot, of 10 vaccines for children in the United States from newborn to age 6. Let me say that again, 28 doses of 10 different vaccines, because a number of the vaccines require boosters. In case you didn't know, most newborns get a hepatitis B vaccine in the nursery before they go home if they're in the hospital. And this is standard practice, at least when I was doing pediatrics, it was standard practice. I'm sure somewhere in there the parent was told, but I don't know if it's the consent, as one may imagine, where you sign on the dotted line before they take action. Now, all 50 states require vaccination for children entering public. Now, here the key is public school, because if you're in a homeschool situation, voucher situation, private school situation, I don't know the regulations or requirements per state for those, and there could be a number of children who do not require vaccination in those settings. I can't speak to that. There are 48 states, in our exceptions being Mississippi and West Virginia, who allow religious exemptions. Now, I don't know enough to speak to what religion forbids vaccination. And there are 19 states in the United States who will allow the parent to object for philosophical reasons. I don't want my child to have that shot. It may have something in it that I don't want him to have exposure. So, in the United States, we tend to protect the concept we have the right to choose. Now, if you're a military and you're listening, I don't think that's the case. I've had many veterans talk about being ordered to line up and stand there and get shots in the butt or the arm or whatever. And I know the anthrax vaccination was a big question mark where different soldiers who were going into potential areas of biohazard were given a vaccine. And there's a reason it was controversial. I don't know how well studied the vaccine they received was. But the military can't, military servicemen in general cannot sue the United States government or the military, and vaccination is blanketly assumed to be agreeable when you join the forces. So there are circumstances where there are no freedoms of choice. If you're traveling to another country, they give you a list of what you need to have been vaccinated. And I don't know any country, if you do not show that on your visa or your passport or the immunization tables that's usually attached to your passport, you're not allowed into that country. So the concept of permission is not worldwide and it's not universal. The question of does a United States citizen have the right to make a decision over their health is what some of the grumbling and noise is all about. Well, the proponents for vaccination, those who think you should get it, say that it's safe and it's one of the greatest health developments of the 20th century. And they point out that illnesses, including rubella, which we used to call German measles, diphtheria, which I haven't heard about in a long time, that's universally fatal because of the bacteria grows this membrane across the airway. Smallpox, polio, and whooping cough. And they say that these conditions have been prevented by vaccine and millions of children's lives have been saved. And the opponents say that children's immune systems can deal with most infections naturally. And that's what I was talking about. Yeah, if you sit out in the soil in short pants or a diaper without shoes and without your shirt, and you pick up a bug or you eat some dirt, or you play with a cat and then you suck your fingers, they're right. Your immune systems can handle that kind of assault in the early years when your body's learning how to defend against outside forces. But a child in a pristine circumstance with frequent alcohol hand washes and sterilized baby bottles and gloved diaper change, this child is not going to develop a natural, healthy immune system, okay? Not to get off the soapbox. Again, the proponents are saying that most infections they can handle naturally, and there's no argument with that. And they say that injecting questionable vaccine ingredients can cause side effects. And these side effects include seizures, paralysis, and death. And they further contend that the numerous studies have proven that vaccines may trigger problems like autism, ADHD, and that's an active disorder. It's a behavioral diagnosis of hyperactivity, behavioral disorder, and they also cited diabetes or pancreatic injury. Now, no one can refute it, and in fact, since 1989 until July 1st, 2014, the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, and I had to stop and laugh and said, if they had to create such a program, there has to be some truth to some of these concerns. They said they made 3,645 compensation payments. Now, in other words, almost 4,000 people went to court or before a panel and were able to convince them that the children had been injured by getting a vaccine. Compensation payments were over $2.7 billion in awards, billion with a B, and $113 million to your lawyers or to their lawyers covering the legal costs. And this is about 30,000 cases of adverse reactions to vaccines have been reported annually. Now, you said 3,000 we got these awards, but annually, that's what, 10% of those annually have been less than, well, if you say that 30,000 a year report something, and they've made 3,000 awards over 15 years, then they're either not giving very many awards or these allegations are not proven to the satisfaction of this committee. At any rate, 4,000 people have gotten $2.7 billion. That's pretty impressive to me. 30,000 cases of adverse reaction are reported annually since 1990. Now, thimerosal, which is a mercury compound, bad stuff, is sometimes used to preserve the life of a chemical on the shelf. You know, you've had, perhaps you've read things where it says do not use after this date, or some chemicals, even some medicines, will say shake thoroughly before taking. Well, part of what a pharmaceutical company, their concerns, especially their bottom line for money, is how long can we leave this particular compound or this particular medicine on the shelf and still get the effectiveness that we've been approved for. And there's a whole side chemistry where they try to figure out how to make things in better solution, how to keep it suspended so that it doesn't settle out. I'm sure you've seen where you have a nice clear solution or mixture, and then after some time there's a fluid at top and more solids at the bottom, and you're told to shake thoroughly. Well, there's all kinds of money spent to figure out what compound can I add to this solution such that it does not separate. And thimerosal is one of those. And then for preservation, if you have to use any kind of compound that has the potential with time to either break into another molecule or change its chemistry dynamics if it's exposed in a liquid for a long time, because some solutions are not static. They, unless you put them in the refrigerator, there's a possibility of reactions, oxidation, reduction reactions to be occurring, such that if you leave it for a period of time, the solution you started with, the function or the activity of that solution may change with time. And they add other things like formaldehyde. Now, we should all be familiar with formaldehyde because that's embalming fluid. It's used to treat wood and any kind of biological tissue or compound to prevent the growth of bacteria and other kinds of breakdown. So I was a little bit surprised to see that vaccines may even have some formaldehyde. And aluminum is another metal that's often added to retard the growth of bacteria and mold. If you look at American medicine cabinet, most of us have a deodorant that contains an aluminum compound. It's well known that underarm creams, roll-ons and creams, you can prevent a very noxious underarm odor by putting a cream that has an aluminum silicate or some aluminum component. It can prevent malodorous sweat. And we know that familiarly by underarm deodorant. So when they're adding things like thimerosal and formaldehyde and metals like aluminum, and in some cases, when I was doing pediatrics, some child had missed a shot. Let's say they didn't come in for the one-month shot, but they showed up for the three-month shot. We'd make a phone call and find out, can we catch the baby up, meaning can we give them multiple doses of different vaccines at the same visit so the parent didn't have to come back later that month. And I remember very clearly giving a child an eyedropper full, which is like a half teaspoon of Tylenol, in anticipation that what we were about to give them as a vaccine could cause fever, it could cause localized pain, and literally give this child two shots on each thigh, because that's usually the largest injectable site for children. So when I started seeing thimerosal and other compounds being added, I think when they did their original calculations to say, well, children under the age of 6 months don't have a blood-brain barrier, that's a concern of what we introduce into the bloodstream for a newborn or a very young child, it can wash over the brain, whereas you and I have a barrier. There's some components that cannot cross the blood-brain barrier. So there were debates on these compounds you're introducing when you give multiple injections are now at a concentration higher than what may have been projected when they said, well, they get a shot when he's 6 weeks old, and then the baby shows up at 3 months and ends up getting four shots. You have essentially quadrupled the concentration of the additives by giving them multiple shots at the same time. And I don't know if that was part of what the congressional hearing was able to bring out, that the potential for a child to get an overload of some of these components was much greater than what may have been anticipated or even presented to the FDA or other approving agencies. And so thermisterol was removed or reduced in most American vaccines for children under the age of six. And I phrase it that way. I think the exception is an influenza vaccine that still has high thermisterol relatively. I don't know if it's parts per billion or parts per million. But the reason I put it in that phrasing, for vaccines used outside of the United States, on the continent of Africa and other areas, there may be still very high preservative, which would be formaldehyde, thermisterol, or aluminum, in these vaccines. And the justification given is that refrigeration is so poor in some of these areas, and transport is so difficult, and stocking is so infrequent, and so forth and so on. There would be others who would question the motivation as to the safety of the person receiving the vaccine, but that's a more political position. Well, the public had an outcry. Started, like I said, a congresswoman had a child that she associated autism with vaccine, and there was a football player who they alleged their son was okay until he got vaccine. And there's been a couple of shows, like 20 or 60 Minutes, where they've evaluated or interviewed families who allege that the problems with their child's ability to walk, to do certain functions, reach certain milestones, the inhibition of these milestones could be directly related to their shot record and behavioral changes. And with all of that, like I said, thermisterol was reduced in the United States for vaccines for children under the age of six, and that's the only one that was addressed. I have no information about formaldehyde or aluminum, both of which frighten me tremendously at the concept of being in a vaccine injected in a child. And after all that said, the Center for Disease Control estimates that 732,000 American children have been saved from death, and 322 million cases of childhood illnesses were prevented between 1994 and 2014. I have no idea how they make their projections. I have worked with the Center for Disease and Prevention. They do have some fancy predictors. I worked with SAS program. I know they do linear regressive studies, regressive correlation studies. So I don't know how they came up with those numbers, but that's the numbers that reported. And it was, like I said, up to 2014, so it is accurate as the publications go. So I put the question out. Who has the right to say no to vaccines? My personal position, I think, is very temporal, meaning the pharmaceutical company that's sponsoring the vaccine, the motivation behind giving the vaccines. As American, I think that it's dangerous not to have your child immunized. And I say that because you can't be with your child 24/7. And if you are putting them in any kind of a public venue, whether you're talking about a playground at the park, if you're talking about a McDonald's, if you stop for a sandwich, if you have a daycare or you go to a party, you ride a public transportation, this child is at risk to contract a virus that could not only make him or her very sick, but can be an instrument of death to someone else. I would not want that on my conscience that I could have allowed my child to be vaccinated. Now, the flip side is, what's the risk of my child being permanently affected by getting a vaccine? And here's the argument. It's iffy if you're going to get chickenpox or measles. You may never. That's true. And taking the vaccine might create some of these horrible things like autism. So what should you do? Well, you be the best parent you know how. Always put the best hope into your child. And I thank you for listening. And until next week, I say stay safe.